Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 16 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. With me is Dr. Eric Hasseltine, a former director of research and development for the National Security Agency and former associate director of science and technology for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, among several other high-level positions he's held within technical fields. He's also the author of the book, The Spy in Moscow Station. Now, I recently read this book, and I knew as soon as I finished it that I had to reach out to him immediately, because this is such an amazing, true story about technical intelligence collection during the Cold War, which is not something I've really touched on a whole lot in the past. So thank you very much for taking time to talk to me today, Dr. Hasseltine. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. I know that you've written several other books and a lot of articles in various publications over the years, but this book in particular looks like a little bit of a departure from your previous work. So can you tell me what it is that led you to write about kind of a thrilling spy story like this?
Well, I like to think of myself as a neuroscientist gone bad. So some of my other books are about neuroscience or about how human brains function in large organizations. So this one grew out of my experience at NSA, where I discovered that we actually have what I would call technical arrogance in this country, where we continue to underestimate our adversaries. And a lot of times we see things that we don't understand because we're actually behind. You know, in today's world, you could look at Havana syndrome as being one example of that. It's not clear that we understand what that is. And you say, well, how can that be? We're the United States. We're the most technologically advanced country in the world. Well, maybe we're not. And that's kind of what the book is about. It's about a mystery whose ultimate unraveling depended on people figuring out that, you know, other people are smarter than us.
That's right. That was for sure the most mind-blowing part and most eye-opening part of the book to me as well. And I'm really glad to dig into that, because I've always very broadly believed that the U.S. was better at technical collection methods, and the Soviet Union, the Russians, they were better at human intelligence collection, at manipulation and that kind of thing. And now I see that that's really not necessarily the case at all, or not the case in a number of different specific fields. So I'm grateful for this chance to learn from you all about that. So going back to the book, it kind of centers on this man named Charles Gandy. And I think that you had the chance to meet him a number of years ago. Is that right? And then he eventually became the subject of your book?
Yeah, actually, when I first met him, I was an executive at Disney, and my boss at the time served on the NSA advisory board and brought him in as a retired NSA officer and smart technologist to see where he could help. And it was funny, because when I first met him in the mid-90s, we called him an information diode. Information only went one way from us to him. He sat there looking like a sphinx and never said anything. Uh-huh. And so I really didn't have much of an impression of him other than he was pretty taciturn. But he interviewed me for the job when I had been approached to join NSA. He voted against me. He said, what's this Disney guy know that could help NSA? This is, quote, a Mickey Mouse idea. And he didn't even like Mickey Mouse. But I did get the job despite his negative recommendation. And he was on the advisory board for NSA. And so I had to report to that board about my transformation efforts to try to, quote, fix, you know, what wasn't working so well at research at NSA at that time. So he took me aside at one of those meetings and told me, look, you're missing something here. And let me tell you a story that illustrates what I mean. And that story is actually the book.
Okay, I see. So can you take us back then all the way to, I guess it starts in 1978 or so. The book covers this investigation into some very odd goings on in the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Moscow. And I know that that embassy has long been a target for the Soviet Union and later on for the Russian government as well. So can you tell us about, before we even get to the 1978 period, what all was going on? How was the embassy being targeted by the Soviets?
Well, you know, it goes back to the fact that we hire Russian nationals to do important work at the embassy, you know, everything from cleaning to administrative and travel and things like that. And so Russian intelligence has forever put their agents inside our embassy posing as those people. So, probably the most fundamental penetration that the Russians have made of our embassy is their staff actually being inside the walls of our embassy. And, you know, they're not supposed to be in any sensitive areas, but you know how it is in any organization. There's kind of a grapevine and informal networks and so forth. And they pick up a lot of stuff. But more than that, they can plant listening devices and other things, which they've done. And so that goes back since we've ever had an embassy, back to when it was at Spassow House, you know, in the 30s through, you know, today. So that's probably the most important one, embassy staff. But the second one is one of the first interesting findings was way back in the 40s, they found a bunch of really clever microphones that were placed behind radiators in waveguides that, you know, picked up lots of stuff. And the microphones themselves were placed quite a ways back, so they were hard to detect. And it had these little tubes that ran out to the wall. Very clever stuff. Then, in 1948, we discovered something really disturbing. Some Soviet schoolgirls, as a gesture of goodwill, had given Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge a great seal of the United States, which he put in the embassy in a very sensitive place. And that thing had what we later found out was a thing called the Thing. And it was invented by this genius KGB officer called Theremin, who also invented the musical device bearing his name, the Theremin. And this device had no power at all. And the way it worked is that you irradiated it essentially with a radar. And you can think of it like a wine glass that at a particular tone, in this case, a radio frequency tone, it would vibrate. And that vibration would change depending on the voice that was impinging on a diaphragm that was there. So it would change the reflection characteristics of an antenna. So it was undetectable. It had no power, it had no wires, it had no, strictly speaking, radio emissions. Because one of the things the Russians do is that they hide these kind of signals underneath normal broadcast signals and so forth in the environment. And so, you know, it's interesting. We didn't really understand when we first captured that thing what it was. And there were certain people in the intelligence community at that time who thought, oh, this is just a penny ante cheap trick. It doesn't really work very well because we didn't know how to really make it work. For example, you had to have very low phase noise in your transmitter to allow this to work and your receiver. Gandhi actually got a hold of it and he was able to make it work. But people, quote, across the river, who we shall not name, were not able to make it work. And so that was a good example of we didn't quite understand it. Then this business of irradiating the embassy with microwaves never stopped and probably hasn't stopped to this day, I would guess, although I don't know. And basically, it works in a similar way in that any electronic device has oscillations, and those oscillations can be read by a radar that looks at reflections from the thing that's oscillating, whether it be a digital line on a computer or whether it's a diaphragm on a phone receiver. It's all the same kind of thing. The Russians call that, you know, the translation isn't direct into English, but their word for it essentially is high frequency imposition. We have a term for that we call radar flooding, which basically means reading things at a distance by illuminating it with a radar. So they've been doing that for a long time. We knew about these signals, and we called them first TUMS, the Unidentified Moscow Signal, and then MUTS, Moscow Unidentified Technical Signal. And NSA knew exactly what they were for reasons I won't go into, but they were 100% certain what was going on. No doubt. And yet State Department and CIA and everyone else had no idea really what they were and actually wouldn't believe NSA when NSA said, look, you know, this is what they are. Even when NSA demonstrated how these microwave attacks worked, people said, well, yeah, okay, you can do that and you're really good. But, you know, the Russians are too backward to be able to do that stuff. And Gandhi, you know, told these individuals, I learned everything I know from the Russians. What are you talking about? So that's kind of the backdrop of the events that began in the book in 1978.
So with all of these different methods that they're just bombarding the embassy with, so to speak, prior to Gandhi arriving, do you know of anything that they were able to successfully collect? Like, what were the end result of all of this collection activity against the U.S. embassy?
See, now there is something I can't talk about.
Ah, okay, sure. I think in the book you mentioned that a few agents had been rolled up in the past, it seemed like.
That's right, they had. And, you know, the problem is when you've got embassy staff inside, you know, cleaning the ambassador's office and so forth, and you have a compromise. I mean, there were many compromises over that period of time, meaning lost secrets from the embassy. To say that it was due to the radars flooding it or due to human penetrations or due to moles in Washington is very difficult to say. And in fact, one of the techniques that Russian intelligence uses is that sometimes they will, allow one of those methods to be exposed as a cover for another one. Let's say they have a mole and they really don't want you to know they have a mole. Then they kind of allow you to find some electronic bugging device so you think that that's the source when in fact it isn't. Or may not be the only source. I mean, these things aren't simple. You know, one of the things the Russians do is they don't usually rely on just one means of collecting what they want to get. They have multiple independent means. You know, A, it improves the chances that they're going to get something, and B, they can cross-check the validity of what they're getting.
That makes perfect sense.
Because, you know, the Russians never assume when they collect intelligence from us that it's honest, real information, because they use what's called disinformatia or maskirovka, where they purposely put out stuff that they know we're going to find that's not true. So we may collect stuff and we don't know whether it's true or not true. Well, so when they collect stuff, they don't know whether it's true or not true. They think we're like them and we fake stuff.
Hmm.
You know, just as an example, it wasn't until very recently that you could even get an accurate roadmap of Russia. They purposely published roadmaps that were wrong.
Oh, wow.
So that an invading army wouldn't know where to go, end up in the wrong place.
Just to confuse the open source collection? Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the Russians are very sophisticated in this game. And so, you know, every time you collect something from them, you always have to wonder. And that's exactly what they want you to do. You may have something really juicy or you may have, you know, squat. And, you know, what you really care about in intelligence is not so much hiding the secret, is you just don't want them to act on the information. If they have the information but don't trust it, it's not as bad.
Right, right. Understood. So this all leads up to Charles Gandhi being sent to Moscow, everything that had happened up to that point. What was it about Charles himself that made him the right man for the job? And what was it that he did once he arrived in Moscow to start working with the State Department on how to tackle these issues?
We'll be right back.
Roe is dead.
Supreme Court has delivered another blow to the Voting Rights Act.
Despite growing dangers from climate change, tonight the U.S. Supreme Court curbing the government's power to fight it.
The makeup of the Supreme Court, the decisions they have already handed down, and the cases they are hearing this year are not coincidental. So what is next? What can we expect from this chaos court and the networks at work to serve them up cases that will expedite their agenda? We'll seek to answer those questions, examining issues at the heart of the cases the court is currently deciding. Follow Grave Injustice wherever you get your podcasts. We're releasing episodes every Thursday throughout the season.
Well, you know, first of all, let's back up a little bit. You know, starting in 1977 and 1978, we had a bunch of Russian nationals who were working for us as what we call assets. Lay people would call them spies. By the way, we intelligence officers never call ourselves spies. We are intelligence officers. The spies are the people we hired to steal secrets for us. And almost always, they're foreign nationals. And in this case, there were Russian foreign nationals that CIA had recruited and were running. And one after another, they're getting rolled up, interrogated, tortured, and executed. This isn't good. And in fact, it got so bad that Stansfield Turner ordered a stand down of all human intelligence collection in Russia. Because clearly something was wrong and we were getting people killed. And it was also making us look really bad. So the guy who was running the Moscow station at the time, a guy named Gus Hathaway, was an old cold warrior. And he said, look, you know, if we can't collect human intelligence, we're not going to get anything on the Russians. You know, he didn't trust technical collection. Human collectors rarely do. But Stansfield Turner, who was actually a naval admiral, not an intelligence professional, wanted to rely on high-tech gear, satellites, and so forth, and, you know, didn't trust human intelligence or understand it. So Gus Hathaway said, look, we cannot allow this to continue. We have got to find out what the leak is that's causing these people to be killed, or we're out of business. So in desperation, he reached out to Charles Gandy, who he remembered from earlier briefings. You know, since the early 70s, Charles had been trying to convince anyone who would listen, hey, you know, the Russians are really, really, really good. And they're eating our lunch, and we got to do something about it. But no one listened to him. But Gus Hathaway remembered one of the briefings. So he did, you know, what really is kind of an unforgivable sin in the CIA is he reached out to NSA, who they have very bad relationships with for reasons we don't have to go into. But you know, they kind of hate each other. And so for him to reach out to Gandy was truly a measure of their desperation. So that was why they brought in Gandy. So they brought him to basically say, find out what the leak is, because we're not able to do it with CIA and State Department resources.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, that's an enormous step out thinking outside the box to bring in an outsider like him to do, would you call it an audit almost, or just an investigation on what was going on there?
Yeah. And, you know, the kind of the way to think about it is, who do you want to burglar-proof your home? A defensive specialist who does home security or a burglar?
Right, right. Absolutely.
And so you can think of Gandy in that light, you know, that he was kind of like the burglar who really knows how to do stuff that you bring in, because Gandy looked at it like, if I were going to do this, how would I do it?
Hmm.
And, you know, so Hathaway brought in the right guy.
So Gandy arrives, and this is, I guess he brings a small team with him, but he doesn't have any or much support at the embassy at that time, because he's got to convince the State Department, he's got to convince the CIA, he's got to convince his bosses back home about what he finds. But he, right off the bat, it seems like he found some pretty incredible stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. He had a team, and they put in very sophisticated gear, and they started hearing things from inside the embassy and from outside the embassy that correlated with each other. You know, there is a really interesting phenomena in the intelligence gathering business, where if someone's listening to you and you know what you're saying, you can sometimes see reflections of that outside that tell you where and what someone's collecting. So like you stare into the abyss and it stares back at you. So Gandy was doing some of that, but he was also listening to transmissions inside the embassy. And he did pick up some burst transmissions that he knew were what we call exfiltration of implants, you know, a frequency hopping burst signal. And he did find it. But just fortuitously, at the same time, there had been, from a year earlier, concerns about strange noises coming out of what they thought was a chimney separating the kind of Russian apartment complex part of the building that was, you know, shared a wall with the embassy and the embassy itself. Before they could go in to investigate, there was a mysterious fire that we later learned was intentionally set by the KGB in the attic of the embassy. So that stopped the investigation of the chimney, as it were, for a year. But ultimately, it turned out while Gandhi was there, there was a State Department team that broke into this chimney, and they found a really interesting antenna and set of electronics leading to cables that were underneath in a tunnel leading into the Russian sector, or Russian territory, as it were, because an embassy is actually U.S. territory. So they knew that there was something going on. And so in Gandhi's mind, the question is there a connection between this mysterious antenna and we found and the clicks, you know, the exfiltration burst signals that he was seeing?
Okay, so they were able to get into this vertical chimney and install an antenna. And this was like a retrans station, something like that. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, it's what we call an LP or a listening post.
Okay.
So if you put an implant that's transmitting something, you've got to listen to that and get the information out. So as I said before, the Russians had free run of the embassy. So how they got the antenna in is no mystery, you know. And by the way, they built that building for us with German prisoner of war labor after World War II. So they probably built hidden chambers in all over the place, knowing what they were going to do.
I didn't know that.
This really was more of an air shaft than it was a chimney, but it kind of looked like a chimney from the outside, and you can see it in pictures of the embassy. So Gandhi took this antenna and the electronics that were attached to it, and he studied it very carefully. And he noticed some things that on their surface made no sense. For example, this antenna was cut to certain wavelengths that he said, well, those are very strange wavelengths. You know, I wouldn't have expected that, because he thought it was what we call a Yagi antenna. But it didn't really make any sense because he wasn't hearing any transmissions exactly in those wavelengths. You know, the length of an antenna is related to its wavelength. So it's typically going to be a half or quarter wave of the wavelength that it's tuned to. So you see that the old TV stations, you had these big antennas with pretty big wires on them, you know, running at right angles to the main post. And then with the higher frequency stuff, you see much smaller ones. Anyhow, so he went into the electronics, and what he found was shocking. You know, it had an amplifier in it with a very high noise figure, which means it was noisy. However, it could handle huge range of power. And what he discovered is there were filters in there that were tuning out what we call interference signals or ghost signals that are created in any kind of receiver when you have very, very strong RF energy from two different wavelengths. In any transistor, there's going to be what's called nonlinear mixing. So if you have frequency of F1, say, let's just say it's 500 megahertz, and you have frequency of F2, say it's, you know, 550 megahertz, you're going to get spurious products, is what we call them, at some indifference value. So you're going to get some at, you know, 550, 650, and so forth. So you're going to get what we call these sidebands or intermodulation products. And those are going to be really strong. So in Moscow, there were these two TV stations that were exactly at those spacing. And when you look at the kind of beat frequencies, if you will, between the carriers of those two, in any kind of receiver we would have that looked for bugs, we would get these ghost signals. And that's where the Russians put their exfiltration. So this antenna had filters that notch those out. So if you didn't have those filters in, you got this huge noise from interference from the TV stations. But when you put those filters in, Gandhi said it was quiet as a mouse. And you could hear signals beautifully. So here they were kind of hiding in plain sight. And they knew that the Russians knew that our receivers that we use to detect bugs would have these ghost signals in them. And so they hid their burst transmissions under them. So Gandhi, when he did this analysis, knew that there was something in the embassy. He knew how it was being exfiltrated, and he knew that the antenna was there, was probably there because the transmitter it was listening to was pretty weak, maybe to avoid detection, or maybe because it had batteries that were wearing out one of the interesting things is when they ultimately found these implants, they found that some of them took power from the device they were in, but some of them had batteries, meaning they knew that a mate or somebody could get in there and change those batteries periodically, which meant the Russians were quite confident they could get access to the bug anytime they wanted to. But this particular antenna that was in the chimney was pointed at the ambassador's office. So it was getting, whatever it was getting was real stuff. So Gandhi actually at that time didn't know what kind of device the implants were in. He didn't know whether it was a teletype machine or what, but he did know it was some kind of text processing device because the data rates that were implied in the burst transmissions were not consistent with voice or other kinds of high bandwidth data. They were consistent with text. So he knew there was some kind of text machine, a teletype, a printer, something that had some kind of implant in them and probably multiple ones because he was hearing burst transmissions at various times that overlapped each other.
Well, he was able to derive quite a bit of information once he got a hold of these devices, but he obviously they had to take these things out of the chimney once they discovered them. So the Soviets must have learned that their listening posts had been discovered. So how did they react exactly once they realized that someone was onto them?
Well, it was very interesting. We filed a protest through diplomatic channels and they said, what are you doing? You're in Soviet territory. You can't go in there. And that's just an air conditioning duct. You know, turned out it was not Soviet territory. It was not an air conditioning duct. So, but the Russians did react. While we were in there, State Department people were in there investigating. The tunnel was closed off and it was booby-trapped. We discovered explosives and tripwires in there. So, you know, the people who went in there did so at the risk of their life. And this has happened before. You know, the Russians do booby-trap things so that if you find them, you die. I mean, they play hardball. Other things that they did is when one of our guys was poking his head down in the chimney, he saw these spike bars come out through fake holes in the brick of the chimney and cut right across. And if he hadn't been quick about it, he would have been impaled by those. So they were doing everything they could to discourage us from continuing to look, from filing diplomatic protests to intimidation to potentially killing our people. I chronicle all this. I was able to get declassified cables that chronicle the communication between Moscow and Washington during this whole interval in which messages were going back and forth about what we were finding, what the Russians were doing diplomatically, and back and forth and back and forth. But basically, the Russians denied everything while at the same time trying to kill our people who were digging into it.
That is just, it's so unbelievable to me that they would set these deadly traps and perform all of these incredibly aggressive actions on U.S. soil, essentially on the embassy. I mean, I can't imagine anyone, you know, the FBI would never do such a thing at the Soviet embassy here in Washington, D.C., for example. But it's really amazing the different perspective that they brought, that they were willing to kill as long as they could continue to collect.
Well, the Brits, because we were very close to the Brits, in the British embassy, their technical security people found some microphones down in the basement and they went to take them out and the Russians flooded the basement and tried to drown the people down there.
Wow. I didn't know that.
I mean, there are other things. I mean, the Russians do play hardball. You mess with us, we're going to hurt you or kill you.
Wow. And lying about everything the whole time and protesting that we're the ones who are doing wrong. It's amazing.
That's right.
That's some integrated disinformation operations for sure.
Yeah, I think the willingness of the Russians to cause physical harm to our people, I think you really have to. Now, we don't really know when, again, you look at Havana syndrome. You know, I don't know, and I don't think anybody really knows what that is. But if whoever is doing it has the same kind of attitude towards our officers as the Russians do, they don't care that there's brain damage or even death. It's just, you know, that's the way it is.
Right. It's such an incredible story that's come out. I usually don't focus with my work. I don't focus a lot on current events, but this is such an incredible return to like an echo of the Cold War, really, playing out right now. It just blows my mind.
That's true. When Gandhi and I first heard about Havana syndrome, you know, we immediately got together and talked about it. And we said, oh my God, this is like deja vu all over again. You know, strange things happen to our diplomats. People don't know what it is. You know, we're still investigating. We're not sure, blah, 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 blah. Anyhow, so yeah, we can return to the book, but there are definitely lessons from this book for today, which is really my motivation for writing the book.
Right, absolutely, yeah. So obviously Gandhi and his team, they uncover this incredible stuff going on at the embassy. So eventually he's got to return to the U.S. and report all of these findings. So what happens at that point?
What happened was, he was basically shut down. You have to remember that he found things that the best State Department security people and other intelligence services that might have been involved were unable to find. So he found stuff that they were responsible for that they had not found. And it really made him look bad. And it also undermined trust in their intelligence product. Like, if you're penetrated in the embassy, how can you trust the intelligence that you're getting from there? You know? And so State Department and CIA were violently opposed to what Gandhi was doing. And ultimately, in about 1980 or 81, the director of the CIA, who at the time was responsible for the whole intelligence community, they had a role similar to what Director of National Intelligence has today. And incidentally, I was the Associate Director of National Intelligence, not of Science and Technology. So I reported directly to the director and he reported to the president. So I was essentially the intelligence office community's chief technology officer. And so the director of the CIA back in the early 80s told the director of NSA, shut Gandhi down. He is to cease and desist. He's causing trouble. And so Gandhi had to stop because the number one boss said, you can't do it anymore. So really, in addition to fighting the Russians, Gandhi had to fight his own bureaucracy.
It's incredible.
So what happened ultimately is that he tried to convince everybody of what he found and get the authority to go over and retrieve what was there so he could figure out exactly what it was. And he was shut down.
That's amazing how these organizations, their reaction is to blame the messenger, to kill the messenger, essentially, rather than try to pivot to face this threat that they had not been aware of. And so I guess meanwhile...
Well, you know, yeah, it's true. I mean, it's human nature, and it comes back to neuroscience of perception. You know, I don't think the people at CIA or State Department were bad people. I don't think they woke up in the morning saying, I'm just going to protect my turf, even if it gets people killed. I don't think that's what happened. I think what happens is, as humans, we believe what we want to and need to believe. Genuinely, we believe it. And so I think at State and CIA, they genuinely believe that Gandhi was on a witch hunt, that it was all science fiction, and that it was all made up in his head. I think they genuinely believe that. And that's why they shut him down, in addition to the fact that he was really making them look bad.
Right. I think, like you mentioned earlier, they didn't really perceive that the Russians were as advanced as he was saying they were. And I guess that they had not... Since they hadn't found it, they just didn't believe that it was really possible.
Well, you know, Gandhi has a problem. I mean, he unfortunately died in May.
Oh, wow.
But I was very close with him for many years. We were very, very close friends, and we collaborated on a lot of projects. To this day, I'm still working on a project that he and I started. And the thing about Gandhi that I discovered that I didn't know until I started actually working with him on a daily basis is that a couple things. One is he understands from his long experience that the secret to success is doing 15 million things exactly right and getting them all to line up. And if you don't do one of those things right, and phase noise is an example of that, you don't succeed. And so when everybody tried to reproduce what Gandhi did, they couldn't reproduce it because they weren't as careful and as diligent as he. And in working with him, I experienced that same thing. He told me to do something. I tried it. It didn't work. And then after about a year and a half of tweaking and tuning, I finally did get it to work. And I realized he was right. It does work. And so Gandhi had that ability to do things other people couldn't do. But also, he wasn't the best communicator. You know, he just assumed that you knew this stuff. You know, like he said to me once, well, you're not using shielded twisted pair, you know, for this particular thing, and you're not using completely balanced with exactly the same wavelength lines, you know, well, of course you're going to do that. And so, you know, Gandhi in some ways was the author of his own problem. And I didn't realize this till actually I started working with him, and it made me understand a lot better why people doubted him.
Okay, so he had a little bit of a off-putting personality or presentation method?
No. He wasn't off-putting. You know, he's the most polite. He's a Southern gentleman, right? He was the most, you know, polite to a fault. He was very likable, very good storyteller, in some ways a very good communicator. But he was one of those people that didn't understand what other people didn't understand. He just assumed that they understood what he did.
Ah, okay, I see.
You know, he assumed wrong. He was very sparse in some ways on communicating all of the details of things. He just kind of skipped over that. And the devil, as they say, is in the details. And I discovered that working with him. I mean, I was eventually able to make everything he claimed would work, work. But man, did it take a lot of work. And it really opened my eyes to if you really want to do something that surprises your adversary, you got to go to extreme lengths to do it.
Okay, I see. So the end result of all this is that for several years, no other action is taken. Once the equipment is pulled out of that ventilator shaft, that Yagi antenna and the associated machinery, nothing else is really done at the embassy, right? No one is fired. No one is let go.
Yeah, it was the Yagi. Yeah, that's right. That's essentially true. Gandhi and other teams did go over there two more times. They did find more stuff that corroborated their initial, but by early 80s, they were shut down. Hmm.
Meanwhile, I guess.
And Gandhi had a lot of other work to do. So he said, well, you can't win them all. And it was to him, he had never lost a bureaucratic battle, which is saying something. And this is his first loss, and it demoralized and depressed him. But he picked himself up and he kept pressing on.
Hmm. So what did turn things around in the end after several years of people ignoring this concern about this problem?
Well, it actually happened in the French embassy. A French maintenance person stumbled on an implant in the Moscow French embassy in a optical scanner. And it turned out that the head of the French counterintelligence had been in NATO with the current director of NSA at the time, a guy named General Odom. And so, you know, cutting across normal channels, normally the French would not share anything like this with us. But because of the personal relationship that was there, it did get shared. So the director showed this ingenious bug, and I describe in the book how the bug worked. Very clever. You know, it used infrared to bounce things around off of many walls to get out to a listening post that was optical, which was quite advanced in those days, which was 1984. This is early 1984 we're talking about. 6 years after the initial detection of the, you know, what was going on in Moscow. And so Gandhi sent one of his top people over to France to look at the thing, and they came back with a report on what it was. They did understand what it was. So Gandhi's pouring this thing over when this guy named Walter Dealey, who's a central figure in the book, he was the kind of number three guy at NSA. He was in charge of information security, InfoSec, which means protecting secrets like encryption, not stealing them. So he was the number one kind of white hat defensive person at the National Security Agency, and indeed for the nation. He was responsible, for example, for protecting presidential communications and the nuclear launch codes. So this was no small person that had come into Gandhi's office. And Dealey, who is quite a colorful character, you know, swears and smokes like crazy. You know, he slams the analysis that Gandhi's guy had made on the table, and he goes, what the F is this? And Gandhi explained it. He says, I know what it is, but look, the frogs, this is his term for them, the French, you know, they're a third-rate power, and the Russians are using sophisticated stuff on them. If they're using this kind of stuff on the French, who are, you know, like a backwater nobody, this was the language that he used, What do you think they're doing against us, their main enemy? They got to have even better stuff. And the fact that we're not finding it means that it's really good. And Gandhi said, well, funny you should mention that. I found something, and I was shut down by the CIA, director of CIA. And Dealey says to Gandhi, well, what would it take to turn that around? And Gandhi jokes, because it'd take a presidential order, because the guy reports to the president. So Dealey nods, throws out his cigarette, and leaves. A few days later, Dealey comes back into Gandhi's office, and he has on White House stationery a memo signed by President Reagan. And it says, I'm authorizing this guy, Charles Gandhi, essentially, to go over there and get to the bottom of this, and you are, whoever you are in the U.S. government, to give him every assistance. So what Dealey had done, because remember I said Dealey was at the White House a lot on presidential comms and other matters. And so he knew people at the White House, including the president. So he just went around the chain of command, around the director of NSA, around the director of CIA, around the Secretary of Defense. He went around everybody, right to the president. And the president goes, huh, all right. Because he'd been hearing, you know, from both sides about this controversy. He said, look, we got to get to the bottom of this one way or another. Gandhi, you have carte blanche. Do whatever it takes.
Wow, that's what he'd been waiting on for years then. Exactly what he needed.
Right, and it really started with a joke. In his wildest dreams, he never imagined that the president would turn him on.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, hard to imagine President Reagan giving you the personal go-ahead on your personal project.
He gave him the personal go-ahead.
So what was the decision then with all the stops pulled out? How were they going to kind of counter this threat or even discover what they've been collecting?
Okay, so what Gandhi did is he organized a retrieval of all potential target equipment in the embassy to be brought back to NSA. And he knew that doing this under the Russians' nose when they got everybody everywhere in the embassy was not going to be easy. And in fact, it wasn't easy. He sent a guy over there who did a, quote, inventory. You know, just he was, you know, he didn't advertise himself from being from NSA, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And he said, I'm doing an inventory of equipment. That's just routine. And he started inventorying and he said, well, we got to modernize stuff. So the cover story was, we're going to modernize this stuff and slowly rotate it out. And the Russians very quickly picked up on what was going on. And for example, they disabled the elevator that was used to get equipment in and out. And they threw all sorts of obstacles in the path. But ultimately, they did get the stuff out. And I don't go into great detail in the book, but Gandhi put a lot of high-tech gadgets inside the equipment to make sure we knew they had not been tampered with. Because you have to ask the question, if they put an implant in something, how did they get a hold of it in the first place? So presumably, whatever method they used to get access to the equipment originally, they could use again to maybe take out a bug if there was one in there.
Right.
So Gandhi was very, very careful in the way that he organized and executed the retrieval of the equipment. But he eventually did get it all brought back to the U.S. and slowly replaced with replacement equipment.
Okay, you're talking about tons and tons of like heavy 1970s.
10 tons of teletypewriters, printers, typewriters, you know, faxes, you name it.
Okay, and this stuff has to be watched, I guess. Is it by diplomatic pouch? Is it going out?
Yeah, again, I'm not going to go into how they got it out. But they got it out, and they had things in the boxes, as it were, where if anyone's going to mess with it, they were going to find out in a hurry.
Okay. I see, like anti-tamper kind of stuff.
You got it. I mean, yes, that's right.
Sure. So what did they eventually find once they got all this equipment back to the U.S. and they were able to examine it?
Well, I mean, the backdrop of this is that Reagan did give the green light to go do this, but he said, don't take forever. Like, my patience isn't infinite. And Dealey got the sense that he had about 3 months to put up or shut up, right? Find something or go home. So he set a 3-month deadline. And he's politically pretty savvy. And I think he was probably right about that. he and Gandhi assembled a team in trailers in the parking lot so as not to call attention to it. Because again, you have to understand, Gandhi assumed, as did Dealey, that Russia had spies inside NSA, which, as it later turned out, was probably true. So they had to keep it so secret they didn't even create a compartment or secret. They did call it, they did come up with a project name for it that came out of something George Shultz, who I interviewed for the book, by the way, to get his side of the story. But he had been hearing all this stuff from his security people bitching about Gandhi. And he might have been the one or his predecessor that told CIA director, look, you got to shut this down. It's making us both look bad. But he basically, when presented with what Gandhi was doing, said, you got to shut him down. You know, have him bring me a smoking gun or I don't want to hear about this again. So Walt Dealey named the project Gunman. Project Gunman, like bring me the smoking gun. So that was the code name of the project, Project Gunman. And what they did is they went off in trailers and they x-rayed the gear. They took it apart. They scanned it. They did all kinds of things.
This must have been a very laborious process because they don't know what they're looking for and they don't know what they're going to find. And they got to take every single thing apart, all these different types of machinery. So was the 3-month timeline realistic for them?
No, as it turned out, because they were running out of time. They hadn't found anything. But you have to understand, you failed to add one other obstacle. The Russians are really good at disguising things. Hmm. So you may have it, but you don't know what you've got. In fact, one of the devices that ultimately was proven to have a bug in it had been found and had been x-rayed by State Department in the embassy. But the Russians knew what kind of x-ray gear we had, and so they designed the implant around so that our x-ray gear and our other scanning gear wouldn't find it. In all, Gandhi found 18 separate what we call hides, which are, you know, cover-ups and disguises, so that even if you've got a really skilled person looking at the thing, they're never going to find it.
18 separate. Were these spread across 18 different devices, or were they in single devices?
No. They were 18 different things. Like, for example, the fact that they were burst transmissions, the fact that they were frequency hopping, the fact that they were encrypted. And then in the device itself, you know, transformers were hidden inside power switches. Seams in metal were hidden by ultra high tolerance machining and tiny, tiny little screws. Power conduits were hidden in really ingenious ways, using center conducting spring loaded things that if you tested it with a voltmeter or just a standard ohm meter, you wouldn't see anything. It would look like a short to ground, but in fact, it wasn't a short to ground. So the Russians were unbelievably ingenious and clever and creative in the way they actually hid this thing. So, you know, it's like a clock is ticking suspense story in that, you know, time is going by and they're running out of time. And in fact, they're running out of x-ray film. They had used all the spare x-ray film that was available in the country. They were having to scramble to find more x-ray film to, you know, x-ray these things. Tens of thousands of x-rays they took and they found nothing. It was getting close to the 3 months and everybody was getting discouraged when a guy named Mike Arneson, who illegally had his wife in there, who used a lot of the word processing equipment that they were actually looking at, you know, he saw something in an x-ray. And he thought, well, it's probably related to these new magnetic card readers that we've heard about. And so he asked his wife, he said, did this particular device have a magnetic card reader? Because she used them. And she said, oh, no, we don't have any of those. And he knew in that instance he had found the bug. And it was in an IBM Selectric typewriter. So he tries to call someone, but it's a 4th of July weekend. He can't get anybody, so he has to sit on this all weekend, and he's going nuts. And Arneson himself is a fascinating story, kind of a classic underdog. At that time, he didn't have a college degree. He was underappreciated, undervalued. He ultimately founded three different companies, a few of which were sold for several hundred million dollars. So he ended up being quite a talent, and it was probably no accident that it was him. But he was also looking, there was a $10,000 prize, which in those days was a lot more money, that had been announced for the first person to find something. And so he thought, honey, his name was Joan, pack your bags, we're going to Hawaii. We just won $10,000.
Wow. And this is right up to the deadline there.
Right up to the deadline. But the controversy didn't end with that discovery. There were NSA supervisors who looked at that and didn't agree with him.
Oh, boy.
And so Arneson went around the chain of command and actually called Gandhi at home, which is very unusual because Gandhi's the equivalent of a major general, and this guy's the equivalent of a sergeant. Mm. And NSA is a military organization. You know, I reported to a general, and I had military officers reporting to me. I had an equivalent rank and all of that. It's very military, and it's a chain of command. But he cut through all of that, and he called Gandhi. He says, look, you got to come down here and settle an argument. So Gandhi comes into the trailer, and he hears this argument between the boss and the guy. And Gandhi is like a god at NSA. So whatever he says at NSA, at least, that's like, you know, coming down from Mount Sinai, right? And so he takes one look at the x-ray, and he looks at Arneson, and he shakes his hand, and he said, congratulations, you found it. Shutting up the guy's boss.
I'll bet.
Then they spent, you know, months and months digging into the details of it. But it was in the IBM Selectric typewriters. It was what we call a keystroke logger. They put little magnetometers hidden inside a power bus that every time you pressed a particular key, it would look at the magnetic signals and decode the text and then transcode it into digital information that was burst out in these burst transmissions.
So they had gained access to the Selectric typewriters. How many different typewriters were they able to compromise? Did you ever find out?
Well, now this is really interesting. They found 18, but there were a lot more than that. And for reasons that we won't go into here, much more recently than that, much more recently, I was studying Russian cybersecurity because they speak some Russian and I speak a lot of cyber. So I was hanging out in Russian language information security websites and chat groups and things like that that were open to anybody. So I wasn't doing anything classified. But, you know, let's just say I was very curious about Russian defenses. I ran across an article by a former KGB officer that said, yeah, they got 18, but they never got the other 12.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, the official account is 18. My own research suggests it might have been closer to 30.
My gosh.
I told Gandhi that, by the way, and he goes, you know, I knew it, because as soon as we found the things, the Russians started building these big coax trenches around the embassy, and I knew they were there to get something. I just didn't know what it was. Now I know.
Hmm.
They still had typewriters in there, and they were still exfiltrating stuff. I mean, that's kind of the disappointing thing about the whole story, is that even when they found the smoking gun, okay, yep, there was implants. You know, people said, oh, well, okay, maybe there were some implants, maybe there weren't, we don't know. But they didn't get anything important. You know, well, they didn't get anything important. They got the cable traffic through what was called the Roger Channel, which is State Department affirming who CIA case officers were undercover. You know, the idea that they didn't get anything useful, and State Department denied that they ever got anything from the ambassador himself, is beyond ludicrous. You know, I'll tell you something. You know, the Russians, as much as they put money into intelligence, they don't have a lot of money. So if they're going to mount an operation that sophisticated with as many listening posts as they had quite a few to collect this stuff, it was because they were getting good take. You know, you don't do stuff for penny ante stuff. No. The Russians got some really, really good stuff. And I was able to look at declassified cables that went out over that were typed. Because when you send a diplomatic cable or a classified cable back, you typed it up on a form, and then that form got put into a, you know, a teletype, if you will, and sent out as a cable back to the United States. So basically, every cable that was written by State Department, the Russians had it.
Wow. They're in the embassy. They've got the run of the embassy. They can read all of our traffic. They can harass people inside and outside. It's just incredible how they had just a complete run of that place then. And
well, you know, the home team does have certain advantages.
No doubt about it. And I know we've done a few things that have come out anyway in open source information about trying to collect on Russian activities here, but I suspect it's nowhere near the level of what they did to us. So I have to ask one thing, and this might be one of those things that you're not really able to discuss, but you mentioned Leo Theremin earlier on. He was the kind of a once-in-a-generation genius developing these devices in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Do you think that the work of these on these Selectric typewriters, which, you know, from the descriptions in the books, they're just absolute masterpieces with those 18 hides that you mentioned that are so incredibly well engineered and well hidden. Was there another genius working on the Soviet side that someone, you know, this generation's Theremin, or was this just like an institutional capability that they had developed up to that point?
Well, I'm going to push back a little bit on your assertion that Theremin was a once in a generation genius. You have to understand about Russian society during the communist era that if you were the 18, if you were the equivalent of a, you know, Elon Musk or Bezos or, you know, Jobs or Gates or the people getting Nobel Prizes in American universities, you went into the KGB.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you got the most money, you got the most freedom, you got the most recognition, you were a party member, the cream rises to the top. And so this was a fundamental problem and remains a fundamental problem. Remember, I was the top technologist in the entire intelligence community, and I know what kind of technical talent we had. And it was really good. But was it like Nobel Prize winning good? In Russia, it was. And so they had a very, very deep bench. Very deep. And they do to this day. Our best brains go to Silicon Valley or MIT to get Nobel Prizes. A lot of their best brains go into FSB, SVR, or GRU.
Hmm. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
You know, and you have to understand from the point of view of a technologist, when you're a really good world-class technologist, you have a passion, a fire in your gut to do something, to make your mark on the world, to make people's jaw drops with the magic you invent. You want recognition. You want resources. It's your baby and you want it to go. And yeah, you're going to go where there are resources. In a place like Russia, there ain't a lot of resources except, you know, in those areas. This is a fundamental problem about, you know, why in some areas they are just so far ahead of us.
Hmm.
It's their talent.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
You know, my dad was a rocket scientist for the Navy. I grew up at China Lake, and, you know, he would come home periodically with Russian things, and he knew I spoke some Russian, so he asked me to translate. So as a teenager, I'm translating these captured Russian documents that he fell into his hands on certain weapons, and I think the Israelis got them during the 67 and 73 wars. And he and I had discussions about the Russians, and he said, you know, Eric, I have seen a lot of Russian technology for the last 30 years, and let me tell you something. Their minds are so different from our minds. They think of things that never in a billion years would we think of. It's almost like aliens.
Wow.
And, you know, I took that mindset into writing this book and then, you know, in earlier work that I did, in that we cannot ever be guilty of mirroring and assuming that because we're like this or we know this, and that's how they are and what they know. Big mistake when it comes to the Russians.
Well, I'm really glad that you were able to put that out there today, because I think that is a very broad misconception that a lot of people had, and that I had as well until pretty recently. So I hope that this is a message that reaches a lot of people as well once they start to listen in on what you have to say and read your book as well.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. If you want to know where the Russians are ahead of us, you don't have to look at them. You just have to look at us. And you say, you know, because if you're the Russians and you have $1 to spend for every 13 America has on national security, what strategy are you going to apply? You're going to say, well, we can't invest in everything. What we're going to do is be really strong and really deep in certain narrow areas that line up with American weakness. So number one weakness is we are net-centric. We are an information warfighting system, right? And so they are the best in the world at targeting information systems. Like Hacking is another word for it. Right? So it's actually no mystery where they're going to be better than us. It's going to be in areas where, you know, our stuff is super sophisticated. If it gets heated up too much, it's going to break. So, you know, they're really, really good at directed energy and electronic warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty damn good at countering our advantages by picking their battles.
Wow, I can tell for sure. We were really well matched against them for sure. It's still stunning to me the things that come out, you know, as recently as your book, and show us how we did not have the advantages that we thought we had in the Cold War. It's truly, truly eye-opening.
Yeah, every now and then we get surprised. We get taught a lesson.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can't go into all the ways, but, you know, the events in my book are, you know, nowhere close to being the only example of areas where they're just light years ahead of us.
That brings me back to the point that you mentioned earlier about the Havana syndrome. I know that you've studied that a lot more than people, and you probably have a much better background and perspective on it. Can you tell me a little bit about what you have found or what you think is going on with Havana syndrome right now?
Well, first of all, I have no data other than what I've gotten in the public. And other than my own personal, you know, I am a student of espionage tradecraft. I am a neuroscientist. And so there's an intersection of my great interests, and that's what drives me forward. So I've written articles about this. And basically, to answer your question, I agree in principle with the conclusions of the National Academy of Science, who say that it's pulsed microwave radiation. That said, I say probably, not certainly. And again, when it comes to directed energy, there's no one better in the world than the Russians. And there are all kinds of wavelengths that we don't spend a lot of time on, like terahertz and, you know, X-ray lasers and all kinds of exotic things. So, you know, I'm not 100% sure. But in an article that NSA approved for release recently, I do comment about something I stumbled on over a decade ago. And it was speculation in the Russian cyber defense community, not others, but cyber defense, expressing concerns about what they call a viral gun. And they said the viral gun that we have to worry about is a radar that doesn't just retrieve information the way, you know, they used to do from the great seal bug, but it inserts information by asserting very high energy pulses on conductors. Malware injected remotely by a radar.
Oh my gosh. That's hard for me to even imagine.
You know, when I first heard about Havana syndrome, I put those two dots together and I said, well, it could be high power microwaves. And, you know, you've got Russian cyber defense people worried about this thing. Is it the same thing? Was this really an intelligence operation to implant malware that had a side effect of hurting people? I don't know. You know, and I actually speculated about that in the article. So being honest, I would say I don't really know. I'm not sure anybody really knows. But one thing I did comment on in my article is that whatever it is, you can almost be certain that it's being hidden pretty cleverly. Because when certain actors do things, they take incredible care to hide what they're doing so that it's hard to discover.
Do you have any insight on what people should look for?
And I, in my article, I raised the idea of ghost signals. If it's RF, are they zapping people in ghost signals? So if you were to scan the environment for something, all you'd see is TV stations.
Yeah, that incredible misdirection there for sure. Wow. Well, thank you, Dr. Hasselstein. This has been super informative for me. Even having read your book, I feel like I learned so many different things from talking to you about it as well. The book that Dr. Hasselstein wrote is The Spy in Moscow Station. It's available now, and I really encourage everybody to read it. Dr. Hasselstein, what else are you working on at the moment? Do you have any other books about NSA history plan for the near future?
No. I just published a book with my wife called Writing the Monster, 5 Ways to Innovate Inside Bureaucracies. It does talk about the intelligence community and how innovations happen there. It talks about how IARPA, the DARPA of the intelligence world, which, you know, I initiated when I was there, how that really got started. So there's a lot of intelligence stuff in there, but not just intelligence. I also talk about experiences at Disney and elsewhere. I am starting a new book, but it's a novel.
Really? Oh, wow.
And it's about, you know, the spy business. And so I decided that I'm going to try my hand. I've written, you know, 4 or 5 books that are nonfiction. I'm going to try my hand at fiction.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Any idea when that might be out?
No, because I'm actually in my laboratory right now because I've got a couple products coming out that I've invented. I got to focus, you know, I got to get those out the door.
Sure. Very understandable. Wow. Well, thank you, Dr. Hafsany. I'm definitely looking forward to your novel as well. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. I think the listeners are going to really enjoy this one as well. So thank you so much for coming and taking the time today.
And great questions. Thank you very much.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101 or connect with me on Patreon. My patrons get exclusive access to long-form blog posts that dive deep into some of the most amazing stories in the history of espionage and receive free or discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. I want to say a big thank you to all of my patrons, including Drew O. and Nicholas M. With your support, I've been able to continue funding my research and publication across multiple platforms to date. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there is lots more to come.
Thanks for listening to this program brought to you by Daydreamer Network. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or your preferred platform. Your feedback allows us to rank on the best new shows list and continue to grow our podcasts in order to bring more unique and talented storytellers to the network. To check out our shows, including programs about relationships, sports, business, nutrition, leisure, and more, head to www.daydreamernetwork.com. We look forward to seeing you back next week for another great episode. Have a wonderful day.